Here we are at Experimental Radio on ABR. Now they can hear themselves. There are people in the studio. I've got their microphones turned off, so they can say what they like for the minute. While I remind people why we're here to find out who's who at the zoo. This is a program called What's Your Story? And basically, we see a lot of people at the supermarket, behind shop counters, down at the beach, and we say g'day. But often we don't really know who they are, and we don't know how they got here. So this is a program that solves that mystery. And some of them grew up here, and a lot of them came from other places. And tonight, I'm joined in the studio by Sally Cannon, who's well known to all of us. Hi, Sal.
Good evening, Bob.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
That's good. And her mum.
Hello, Bob.
Now, people call you Maz.
Well, it's probably it's happened because it's an easier name to remember than Marion.
Marion. But Marion is a much more musical kind of, pleasant kind of name.
It's not Marion, not Marion.
Oh, Marion?
Marion.
No, Marion.
Marion. M-A-R-I-O-N.
Yeah. Marion. Yeah, Marion. I say Marion. Maz is a much more Australian. Yeah.
And my dad's name is Barry, so they get Maz and Baz.
Maz and Baz. Where were you born, Marion?
I was born in Williamstown.
In Williamstown?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And grew up there and went to school there and worked there and then had met Barry.
Yep.
Married and had Jane and Sally.
Wow. That's the shortest life story I ever heard.
Okay. Well, thanks, Bob. That was a great chat. We'll be off now.
So tell me... more interestingly, when you were growing up in Williamstown, what was it like there?
Well, you really didn't sort of tell people where you came from because Williamstown was sort of like the end of the earth. It had a reputation of the end of the line. You know, you'd go out and you'd never ever say you came from Williamstown because no one would ever take you home. And Williamstown was an interesting place because it was a little bit, in the years when we grew up, it was a little bit like a polar bay. It was a very community-minded place, but it was a divided place. You had the south end and the north end.
Right.
And the kids in the north end, where we were, weren't allowed down the south end because that was where all the pubs were and the waterside workers were and... the trouble was, and so we were never allowed past Ferguson Street, which was the main street. So, but then over the years, Williamstown sort of became known and became quite trendy.
Mm. Were you in a big family?
No, I was just. I have a brother.
Yeah.
But we're a big sort of
extended family.
Family in Williamstown.
Mm. Yeah.
My mother was actually born in Port Ferry.
Right.
And her father was the harbour master in Port Ferry.
Okay.
But at the age of 3 months, they came to Melbourne. Mm. He was transferred to Williamstown. And then she was the firstborn. And then she had a brother and a sister. And then they've all had kids. And so they all live in Williamstown. They all still live in Williamstown.
So all thick as thieves.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not thieves.
Very much so.
Not many of them anyway.
Just a couple. We don't talk about them.
And at school, were you a bright student, clever girl? Or
well, I thought I was. But in year 10, in those days, you know, my friends all decided they wanted to leave and so I left.
Mm.
And tell Bob about your first job, like Pop got you a job.
My father was the maintenance engineer at the Newport Powerhouse.
Okay.
And in those days, you know, they organised, jobs for their kids. So I was given an opportunity of a job with the SEC in Flinders Street in the head office. Dad had organised it. So I got a letter to say that, you know, I was to start on the 12th of January. And I said, well, look, I can't start that day because that's my birthday. And and I need to have my school holiday. So I'll start when school goes back. Oh, okay. So he organised that. So amazing. I started when school went back. And off to work I went, and I had this job where I can't remember what it was. It was checking figures and so forth. And I had to share a locker with another girl. And I went the first day and then I went back the second day. And at afternoon tea time, I said to the girl, can I have the key to the locker? She said, what do you want it for? I said, oh, I'm going home. She said, no, you can't go home. You've got to wait till 5 o'clock. I said, no, I'm going home now and I'm not coming back. So I went home. I rang Dad and Dad picked me up from the Newport station and he said, well, what do we do now? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, look, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, I'll ring the manager of Williamstown Hospital. He's in the fishing club and we'll see what we, you know, if he can get a job. So I started at the Williamstown Hospital the next day in the office.
He's pretty well connected.
So that's what used
man.
To happen in those yeah. days. You yeah. just went from job to job until yeah. you found something that you liked.
And there were plenty of them.
Plenty of work.
So what did you like in the end?
Well, I liked the fact that there was sort of a help, you know, a care and a helping people. Mm. And I dare say that sort of came from our whole family. Our whole family is sort of, you know, quite charitable in lots of ways, taking in people that, you know, couldn't afford things and, yeah.
So you're 16, 17?
I was 17.
17. Mm. So you're starting to go to dances and...
Starting to go to dances.
Field some inquiries from young fellas, from keen young blokes.
Well, that was when, you know, the era of, the Seekers. No, Judith Durham was singing out at a place in Moonee Ponds. We used to go out there. And then we used to go to a place called 431 in St Kilda Road.
Yep.
But, of course, you'd never say you came from Williamstown. So...
So, really, it was like Broadmeadows became.
Yeah, exactly.
However, it doesn't stop you. Doesn't stop the blokes being interested. They don't care where you come from.
But so, then I was at the hospital for about 5 years, I suppose, and then one of the doctors seconded me and one of the nurses to work in his private practice, which we did. Mm. And it was in that practice that. There was another girl that husband played football and he said, you know, there's a great guy that's, you know, why don't you come to the barbecue on Saturday night? Mm. And I said, oh, no, I'll go surfing. And they said, oh, just stay home 1 weekend. That'd be, you know, be worth it. Anyhow, I did and that's where I met Barry.
Okay. So surfing. So you were...
I was a surfing chick. Yep. Okay. Yeah. Used to surf from Point Lonsdale down to Joanna.
And did you get a bit of stick from the blokes?
Well, it was
early
a bit
70s?
Rare. It was
yeah, it was
no,
rare.
No. It was early 60s.
Early 60s, so very rare.
I had a little Ford Prefect, 1953 Prefect, with a surf rack on the top, and there were three of us.
Yeah.
And we used to surf from Point Lonsdale, as I said to Joanna, we'd chase a wave.
So you're a young woman who clearly knew your own mind and wasn't too concerned with conventions, because some of this behaviour would be...
It was a bit out there. We used to stay in what they used to call the snake pit at a hotel, the Victoria Hotel in Queenscliff, and that was right down and was sort of under the bar. I think was where you know it was the snake pit.
Yeah.
Anyhow, Mum would say to me, "Where are you staying?" And I say, "Oh, staying at Roger Green's place, Mum." Mm. Oh, okay. Now, Roger Green was a surfer and he was from Williamstown. And she actually met Mrs. Green one day and she in the street and she said, oh, look, thanks very much for, you know, looking after my daughter. And that was when the truth came out. I wasn't staying at Roger Green's place. I was staying in the snake pit.
So you clearly had a lot of fun in those days.
Oh, yeah. It was good. They were good days.
And you always, because you had there were two girlfriends you were getting out in the surf with?
Yep.
And so there were three of you, you were pretty safe.
But then in the end, there were more, you know, I mean, we used to get houses in Point Lonsdale and stay there and got to know the locals in Queenscliff and they'd take us over to Mud Island and it was good times. We'd go to quarantine to surf, which was a good wave.
And so then you met the bloke?
Then I met Barry.
Okay. And how was that? You were introduced to the
barbecue? I was introduced. And look, it was okay. But then a couple of days later I thought, well, it would be nice if he rang.
Yeah.
Anyhow, he did. He rang. And he actually was playing football with Footscray at the time, and another boy there, Merv Hobbs, was also in playing, and they were both in the printing business.
Okay.
So they decided that they would, on the side, set up their own little printing business and do it of a night time. Anyhow, they got a big job this particular day for Kraft Cheese, and they decided to take the day off each, chuck a sickie. And they were both working away at their little presses. They'd rented a room in Williamstown. And their both bosses came down. They were different organisations. And they came down and they got the sack on the spot. So that was when Barry rang me that day. he reached out for help. So we all went out that night to the Essendon Airport. There used to be the sky, what was it used to call, be called? The Sky Bar? They used to have a bar at the Essendon, So we all went out there to the Sky Bar, and that's, you know, the start of it.
That was the beginning. That's where so a bit of electricity happened. And so then he went on to run his own business? Unemployed, so better make a go of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they ended up, they then bought... they decided that there was the old Chronicle newspaper, which was in Williamstown, had shut down, but the business was for sale. So they looked at it and thought, well, you know, maybe we should buy that. Mm. Anyhow, I think it was sort of, you know, $12,000 for the business and $12,000 for the property, something like that. I said, Barry, you'll never pay it off. Never pay it off. He said, well, we're going to do it. Okay, so they did it, and that was it.
Mm. And it worked.
It worked.
Yeah. Mm. So how long did he squire you before he popped the question? Or did you pop the question? How did that happen?
That's funny, because we went on a holiday to Mount Buffalo Chalet with Mum and Dad in the September, and he asked me to marry him, right? He was engaged.
Mm.
And when the 9/11 happened, I said to Barry, this is the day we got engaged, on the 11th of September.
Yeah.
He said, oh, rubbish, how do you know that? I said, I had it engraved on the inside of my engagement ring.
Yeah.
I'll bet you that's the day we got engaged. He said, well, show me. I said, oh, look, I haven't got that ring now. I said, I gave that to Jane.
Mm.
So he rang Jane and he said, this is the day of the when it all happened. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And he rang Jane and he said, Jane, your mother tells me that she's given you her engagement ring and the date's got the 11th of September on it, which is the day that, you know, this is all happening today. Can you have a look at it? And she said, oh, I can't because I've given it to Sally. So I rang Sally. So I said, look, Sal... You know, da-di-da-di-da-di. And at that time, Sally and Mick were managing Whitecrest.
Mm.
And in doing that, they'd taken all their furniture out of their house in McLennan Street and they'd put it in our garage at our place. So I said to Sal, da-di-da. And she said, oh, look, I can't. She said, I said, why? And she said, well, it's in the shed. Barry said, in the shed? That ring's in the shed. I said, yeah, it's in the shed. So eventually we found that we got the ring, and sure enough, it was the 11th of September, 1966.
Right.
No, 1965, sorry.
65.
Yeah.
So, and how long did he, how long were you going out before he popped the question?
Oh, well, it was about 18 months, two years. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So, and it was a good old fashioned.
Yeah, it was the proper,
an appropriate courtship.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
He asked Pop,
yes. Mm. And it was a Sunday night's dinner. We used to always have the cold meat and salad on a Sunday night with the glass of a celery in the middle of the table.
Mm. Yeah.
And then the scones and jam and cream. That was always Sunday night's dinner.
Yeah.
And then he asked Pop and did it the right way.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were
coming up 50 years in November.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
Mm.
So it's working well so far.
Sort of.
Don't delve too deeply. But these are my parents we're talking about.
So you were married the year later, or?
Yes.
About a year. Usually it was about a year.
1966.
66, yeah.
So 50 years.
66, the year of the dollar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
And a big turn?
Yes, yeah, it was. Yeah,
all the Williamstown crew.
Yeah,
Dad always laughs because they've got, you know, the wedding album, and you flick through it, and it's all nicely done, and on about the second last page, there's finally a photograph of Dad.
So then I was still. Oh no, I was working. That's right, for the doctor, the private doctor surgery, and then. What happened after that?
Was he a surfer?
No, Barry wasn't. No,
he was a footballer.
No. He was a footballer.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a waterman at all, really?
No.
Dad played in the reserves grand final for Footscray. In what year was it, Mum?
62.
Under Charlie Sutton?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And he would have been a better footballer, but he had to wear glasses and he couldn't see the ball.
All right. There you go.
Yeah. Hmm.
And so you married, so then you move into a little rented place? Or?
No. We bought a house in Williamstown in a little dead end street. I think there are about eight houses in the street, and three of them were all in our family. We all lived in the one street.
Okay.
And.
So he wasn't a Williamstown boy originally?
No, he was
though.
Footscray.
Okay.
Yeah. Footscray
boy. Near enough.
Yeah.
Near enough to know that it's not really as bad as it's painted. Yeah. So you bought a little house. So the printing, you obviously paid back. The two lots of 12,000, no problem at all.
he printed the money and got it paid back the next day. Don't tell anyone.
I went to school with a kid whose dad did that. He was in the newspaper for his trouble. Okay, so you got your little house.
Got
so
a little house.
Straight into the family or waited a while?
No, within...
Jane was born in 68. So probably
68, and then Sally was born in 69. Mm-hmm. And then what happened after that?
You went and worked for Ref Shorgie.
Then I went to work with Ref Shorgie. In those days, the specialists were all in Collins Street, and this particular, he was an ear, nose and throat specialist, and he decided that he would bring the specialist to the suburbs, and so we set a practice up in Williamstown where we had gave rent free for 3 months to try it and see what happened. And we had six specialists, and it worked very well. So that was,
So the family weren't, you haven't spoken, no big religious streak through the family?
Well,
regular churchgoers?
Oh, yeah, we were regular churchgoers, We were in the congregational church and
Mum's
Sunday
cousin,
school. And
Mum's cousin, Auntie Pauline, she would play the organ. So
always went to church on a Sunday.
Right.
And
although I stopped going to Sunday school when God wasn't there.
Yeah, no, I'd say to Sally, now, did you have a nice day? No, I'm not going next week because God wasn't there today.
So I stopped going.
Shades of me there, I think.
so you stopped working once the kids were born?
No. Still kept working.
Okay.
And then...
So how did you manage that in the day, family?
She can't remember. We don't know who taught us to walk or talk or brought us up. None of us can remember, including Mum. but someone must
My mother lived three doors down the road, four doors down. Yep. So, you know, with that support, it was fine.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, I used to, actually Jane and Sally were both brought up in the waiting room and in the doctor's surgery because I'd take them to work and every now and then, you know, if I had to feed them and I was busy, I'd take them in the waiting room and give a bottle to one of the patients and say, "Can you feed my baby?"
So it's a big part of what you do, of who you are, your work. And you did that all the time?
Yeah, I did that. I worked for... worked for that same surgeon for 23 years.
Wow.
And then Interplast came along. Mm. And Interplast was the voluntary plastic surgery foreign aid program. Mm. And how that happened was that Barry was in the Williamstown Rotary Club and he had the job of doing the weekly bulletin this particular year.
And he hated it.
He didn't. He would come home and he'd say who the speaker was and I'd actually write it.
Yeah.
And he had this particular day, he came home and he said there was a guy there and he talked about Interplast, you know, they're trying to set up an organisation here for plastic surgery in the Pacific, you know, and I thought, gee, maybe I could be of some use to the organisation. So I rang the Rotarian involved and told him who I was and what I did. Mm. And he said, and I said, if I can be of any help, I'm happy to do that. So I didn't hear from him. And then I got a notice of meeting of the first medical subcommittee to be held at the City and Overseas Club there in Dandenong Road. And so along I went. And I was the only female there. And this Rotarian said to me, could you take the minutes? And I said, yeah, I'll do the minutes. So I did that, and they had their meeting, and I took the minutes home, and I thought, well, somebody's got to do the business of the minutes. So that's what I started to do. And then they decided that they needed to find more out about this organisation, which was started in America in Stanford University. So they decided to send me on an American program to Ecuador to see what the whole thing's about. And how they go about it.
And this was in 83?
No, this was 82. 82.
And what was it about? It's about...
Well, it's about providing a service that's not available to these, you know, parts of the world, the developing parts where kids are there with their cleft lips and palates.
So it's mostly to do with plastic surgery.
Plastic and reconstructive surgery,
okay.
A lot of burns.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I was there with this American team, and it took me 2 days to decide how not to go about a program. This team that I was with was 12 surgeons, 10 anaesthetists, 15 nurses and 72 boxes of equipment all landed into this little hospital high up in the Andes.
Good grief.
And it was just overwhelming for the locals. So I came back and I reported to the committee that, you know, really what you need to do in a situation is, you know, in a developing country is go slowly and take it easy and do it small, start small. So that's what they decided to do. And with Rotary funding, we sent our first program to Samoa in 1983, all fully funded by Rotary.
Okay.
And while we went to Samoa, was the Americans had a program in Samoa, so we shared it with them. And our surgeons from Australia joined the American surgeons, and then eventually the idea was for us to take over. Anyhow, it didn't take long before the Australian government contacted me and said that they would be interested in giving us some funds to extend this service to other parts of the Pacific because there was not one plastic surgeon in the whole of the Pacific.
Wow.
And there are all these untreated, you know, cleft lips and palates. And so the Department of Foreign Affairs gave us this money and we sent a program into Fiji. And then it was such a success, they said, we want to give you some more funds. We need you to go to Tonga. And so over a period of about 4 years, we had a program right throughout the Pacific.
So had you become a permanent
volunteer? Well, what happened? No, I was doing it voluntary. I did it for...
So you were still holding some sort of job?
Yeah, I was still working for the ear, nose and throat surgeon and doing all this, you know, at the same time. And then the president of the Interplast said to me, look, you're going to have to come. He was a plastic surgeon. He said, you're going to have to come and work with me. He said, this is, you know, we can't. It's not working. You know, you're over in Williamstown and I'm in Kew and, you know, you need to. I said, no, I'm not coming. I'm not leaving Williamstown. I've lived there and worked there all my life. And then within a couple of weeks, the surgeon that I worked for, he decided he was going to retire. So cut a long story short, he retired. And so I thought, well, I'll give it a go. So then I started to work for the plastic surgeon in Kew and still do Interplast.
Yeah.
But it got to the stage where you can't work for 10 hours a day and not get paid for it. So they decided that they needed to, gradually building up the corpus, and they decided that they needed to employ somebody full-time with Interplast. So I said, well, nobody else is going to do that but me. And so that's what we did. But it was interesting because it went from a level of me being a volunteer on the same level as the surgeons and the nurses to then getting paid.
Employee.
And so, I was getting paid. Yeah. You know, she gets paid, she can do it. Well, I soon knocked that out of them.
So all this time, this is 83. How old are you now, Sally, at this time?
I would have been 12.
Okay.
So that's how they learned to cook.
That's, I say my sister and I learned how to cook roughly about the same time Mum went to work for Interplast. Because we'd get home from school, where's Mum? We'd ring Dad, where's Mum? She's in Fiji or she's in Tonga or she's in Samoa. We never knew where she was. Okay. And so we had to look, if we wanted to eat, we had to cook.
So did you get a bit annoyed about that? Did
no,
you get,
not at
no?
all. No.
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 Cause
it was a great learning curve for them. Their geography of the Pacific was, you know, it was great.
But also a pretty decent bit of role modelling about how to get on with your life. And and you and Barry were together and happily independent as well,
yes,
obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Very much so.
So this is liberation without all the hoo-ha. Yeah.
But when you enjoy what you do, it really is. It's an easy sort of chore. You know, you don't think
Absolutely.
About it. You don't. There's nothing else. You know, you just do it.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So you did that again now for another.
Well, then I did that for 28 years.
Wow.
And that was it was. When at the time you sort of, you know, you just keep working and you expand and you extend and all the rest of it, and you don't realise. But when I sit down and reflect on it now, starting in Samoa and then extending right throughout the Pacific and then into Papua New Guinea and then across to the Philippines, it became like an arc around Australia.
Yeah.
And we ended up with, you know, Indonesia, Vietnam, Burma.
Bangladesh,
Pakistan.
And that work's still going on.
It's still going on, yeah.
Same essential organisation, same MO.
Yeah. Done in a different way, but, you know, the organisation is still working and it's still expanding and, you know.
So
good. And
it?
It's training. It's all very well to provide this need, but you've got to be wanted to do it, But you've also got to make it sustainable, and so you've got to do the training at the same time. So we actually trained up the plastic surgeons in the Pacific, and now there's, you know, there's trained local plastic surgeons in right throughout the countries.
So you were doing this. So you retired from this when Sally was how old? When the girls were?
When we bought the bakery.
Oh, okay. So just only, how long ago is that?
Five years ago. Yeah.
I'd retired. I'd got to the stage where the organisation, we had what was called base accreditation with AusAid, with the Australian government, and we needed to go to full accreditation to keep expanding. And that's sort of, you know, on the level of World Vision and Oxfam and Red Cross and that. And I just decided that, you know, I really have brought it to that level, and I'm quite happy to step back and let somebody else that has the expertise to take it to that level, and that's what happened, and handed over, and quite happy to sit back and watch it still grow.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's a great story. And did you get much surfing in those years when you were going to those places?
I don't think my knees could get me up now.
Just can't get a hair wet.
But when you were going to the South Pacific. So it was just some work stuff.
Did it? Oh, look, you'd get a bit of R&R, and you know, in Fiji with a bit of diving and out to the weekends at the islands and that, but no surfing.
And meanwhile, back on the home front, these couple of teenage girls, what are they giving you any trouble?
I don't think
Jane did. Jane was dreadful. I was fine.
She suggested something a bit different.
Did she?
She did.
She's a wag.
So your mum wasn't around a lot.
She was, but then, you know, when she had to go away, she was away. But but mum sort of...
I would only ever be away for 4 or 5 days.
Yeah, mum's the only person that we know, and even Mick, my husband, jokes, you know, your mum can go around the world and be home within like 2.5 days. So if mum would get there, she'd do what she'd have to do, and she'd be straight home. So she didn't sort of linger any longer than she had to. So
you at no time felt deprived of
never.
Your mum's presence or whatever?
No.
Did it mean you got on a bit, you got to know your dad a bit more? Did he cook and do domestic
stuff? To be honest,
stuff?
We never sort of really gave it much thought. That was just how we lived.
Just the
and
way
she
it was.
I mean, she was away a lot, but not, you know, it wasn't that she was never around, but it's just, you know, she'd go off on these little 2 or 3 day things and then come home. So, But one of the stories I'd like to tell, which I think Mum probably won't, when they first went to Fiji, one of the very first patients, or one of the, his name was Tamo. He was a school teacher, and he had he was a burns victim, and he had all his fingers had fused together. So he was a school teacher, but he couldn't write on the blackboard because he couldn't use his hands. Yep. So he had the operation where they, you know, freed up his fingers and everything. And one day a letter arrived for Mum and you know, the Interpass team to, that he had handwritten, thanking them that he was now able to write on the blackboard. And that was really...
Yeah. There's that. Look, there's so many lovely stories, actually. I was thinking about it last night, actually, and we used to bring patients back to Australia too that couldn't be up. You know, the facilities just didn't allow the operations to be done there. And there was a, I was contacted by a Major Andrew Irwin from the American Army, who they were working in Laos. They were still excavating the dog tags and identifying the, you know, the lost soldiers. And he came across this little girl with her mother, and she had what was called a cancromoris, where the infection just eats away and it just eats and eats. And he was just devastated when he saw this poor little child. He took the child back to the hospital in Vientiane. And as soon as they give them antibiotics, it gets rid of it. But over the years, or over a short period of time, they then contract in their healing process. And it was just, she was horrific. Anyhow, so they decided, he put this, you know, came on the internet this day. And I thought, oh, I've got to help this child. So we bought her. To Melbourne, to Cabrini. Cabrini Hospital was, you know, they were fantastic. And she came out on her own. And when I think about it, he dressed her up in her Nike shoes that were too big and her jacket that was too big. And she got on that plane and came all the way. The faith and that she must have had in, you know, these gringo doctors to help me. Though, you know, the desperate people do desperate things, and you know, she came,
and there was a lot of them like her that you sort of, you know, you used to say it's terrible because you bring them over and you fix them, but then you send them back to the, you know, they're living under a fern leaf or something. They've had a taste of Western life and they quite enjoy it.
They get to, you know, the electric light switch and the hot and cold water and all that, and then they've got to go back to... So in some ways you help them, but I'm not sure in other ways, you know.
So this culture of service that's clearly in you and in your family, where did that come from? Did that come from your folks and other relatives?
I couldn't always remember my grandmother saying, you know, you do unto others as you wish them do unto you.
So your grandmother is...
I mean, grandma, you know, don't do that, grandma won't like it. That was what we were growing up with, you know, you got a new dress, go and show grandma. You know, and grandma became a bit of a, you know, she was the... She guided us, I think.
Okay. So, and so then you coming to Apollo Bay... and being, you know, part of the bakery expedition and stuff. How did all that work out?
That happened was that Mick's brother played football here, and Mick started playing football back in
the early 80s.
And then when you got married, he had a job at Werribee Park, but he applied for a job at Parks and he got the job down here at Parks.
Okay.
So they got married. In the March. And
so you married a footballer too?
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. So they married in the March, and Sally, and they had their honeymoon and came back, and Mick came back to Apollo Bay to live, and Sally continued to live with us in Williamstown.
Another woman of her own mind.
So I thought, you know, that was okay for, you know, a couple of months, and then Barry said to her one day, look, Sally, you know, you really are married. You really shouldn't be here, you know. Well, I haven't got a job. I said, the only way you're going to get a job, Sal, is get down there and a job will happen. And that's what happened. So then, of course, you know, we used to come down at weekends and that was fine. We'd be in the caravan in their backyard and it would be freezing cold. And poor mother, she was, you know, like in her late 80s, she'd have to get up in the middle of the night and go to the toilet.
So grandma came too.
Oh, yeah, grandma came too. And then we decided we'd buy a house.
Mm.
So we then, you know, had our place and we used to come each weekend.
Yeah.
We'd come 7 out of 8 weekends. And that was in 95.
Yeah.
So we've sort of, you know, been part of the community
for quite a while.
And then I like to say we accidentally bought the bakery. That was a very quick decision when we did that, and it sort of basically, you know, changed everyone's lives. Mum had all the, and Dad basically retired. They were all set to do their retirement thing, and Mum will be at the bakery now with her head in the sink. You're saying, I used to travel the world.
I don't know what happened.
I don't know what happened. Now I'm washing dishes. What went wrong?
So, and the whole clan's here, pretty much.
The whole box and dice.
Well, Jane, she had a good job. She was at in an educational publishing organisation, and so she took long service leave to see how to go. So she came down here. And Barry and I stayed in Melbourne with the kids because they were still at school. And Jane's husband, Rick, he goes to sea, so he was at sea.
Yeah.
And so she then did her long service leave and then decided this was it, she wasn't going to go back. So we brought the kids down then and they went to school for the last couple of weeks in the year and then started fresh.
And here you all are.
Here we all are.
Here we all are. And so Sally's always been Sally. There's no particular event that's caused this.
Look, I think there is, actually. Yeah. I think when I think about it, Sally, am I allowed to? At the age of 6, Sally had a tumour on her liver.
Okay.
And in those days, their diagnostics that were here, the only thing they had was angiograms. They didn't have ultrasounds, they didn't have CAT scans, they didn't have MRIs, nothing. Anyhow, this tumour that she had, they couldn't diagnose what it was, and it was a cancerous tumour for 6 weeks. And you live with a child that's 6 years of age that has a tumour that's cancerous. It's pretty devastating. And then They brought in an oncologist from Peter Mac to start chemo. And he said, I'm not going to start chemo until I get a definite diagnosis. So they decided to take a piece of the tumour and they sent it off to the Mayo Clinic in America and also to a Sheila Sherlock in London. And it was Sheila that actually diagnosed it. It was a very rare tumour to be seen in a child. They'd never seen one in a six-year-old.
Wow.
They see them in bodybuilders that have been on steroids. And it was a benign tumour. So after 6 weeks, to be told that your daughter has a benign tumour.
You just got out of jail 3 times.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I understand what it's like to be in a situation where there's nobody that can help you. You know, for 6 weeks, we were sort of, we didn't know what was going on. And these people in these developing countries, it's the same situation. I related to them.
Perfectly well.
Yeah.
And of course, and so you had a great appreciation for life.
Absolutely.
From a really early age. So every day's a blessing. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So then she had to... she grew up with this tumour, and the danger of it was that it was a tumour that was the size of a grapefruit that made up of blood cells. And so the danger that she could be in was a knock to it would just be blood. And anyhow, when she came out of hospital, she was in the Alfred for, I don't know, how long, Sal?
Three months.
3 months. And we couldn't get her better. She was, you know, pretty... down, and so my mum and dad, they would go to Queensland for the winter. So we decided that maybe a change in atmosphere, change in temperature and everything. So she went off to Queensland. The first day she was there, all she wanted to do was go jump on the trampoline. And my mother was, I said, Mum, just let her go. If that's what she wants to do, let her do it. So she was fine and she came home a different girl.
Okay. Wow.
So then... can I continue with the story on you? And then for years she went through this with the getting married and so forth. And then after she was married, she got an earache and she went to the doctor in the city. And he said, do you have any other medical conditions? She said, oh, yeah, I've got a tumour on my liver. And he said, a what? So he said, who looks after it? Well, of course, she'd outgrown the paediatric surgeon and he'd actually retired. So there was no one that looked after her. So he said, look, I think, you know, we'll get Professor Hardy at the Austin to have a look at you, which we did. And he said, look, you know, she really needs to have that removed because it'll come to a liver transplant if we don't. But the problem was it was part of it was attached to the right hepatic artery, which is the main artery in the heart. So she then, you were married in the
March,
and in the October she was subjected to the removal of this tumour, which was a 10-hour operation.
Wow.
And look at it now.
Yeah.
So there's still a percentage of it that is still there, but it's, you know, it's fine.
Well, it's been an amazing story.
Yeah.
And I don't know why I thought to talk to you, Maz, but I'm really pleased that I have. And it'll make a wonderful contribution to the many stories that we've collected here on What's Your Story. Thank you very much for coming in and sharing.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, good on you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks for bringing your insight.
No, my pleasure.
Sharing a little bit of yours.
Yep, no worries.
We might talk to you another day. Well, we're going to have the Sally Cannon radio program, you know, here in Apollo Bay, so you don't have to go to Geelong anymore.
That'd be good.
We'll get around to doing that. This has been What's Your Story on 3 ABR.